Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. We often talk about challenging topics here on Medical Monday, eternal themes like pain, suffering, and end of life. Frequently, these topics intersect with the big C, cancer. Usually, the folks we interview are from the world of medicine, doctors, nurses, scientists, patients, even journalists on the beat for concoctions and cures. Today, we approach cancer from another angle, the humanities. And due to personal and family circumstances and an insatiable curiosity coupled with a beautiful writing style, my guest has explored her subject and made it come alive for a general audience. My guest is Anna Leahy, who is a professor of creative writing at Chapman University. Her book is simply called Tumor, and it's part of a larger series called Object Lessons from Bloomsbury, in which each writer in the series tackles one object of their fascination in about 25,000 words, less than half of the average book's length. The volumes are small and elegant, and they have a beautiful feel to them. They are designed for quick but thought-provoking reading. Leahy is also co-author of the book Conversing with Cancer, How to Ask Questions, Find and Share Information, and Make the Best Decisions. Anna Leahy is our guest today on Studio Tulsa, Medical Monday. Anna Leahy, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by just having you describe how, well, the first chapter says it all, Tumor in the Family. How did you come to want to write about the topic of tumor?
Well, I think nobody wants to write about cancer, but I was faced with my father's diagnosis of cancer when I was turning 16 and he was only 48. And I think that reshaped my life. I was in high school. I went off to college. He was still sick. He died while I was in college. He died over the summer, so I was home with him. And I began writing about that, but not very well. I went on to college and graduate school and became a better writer, and that subject matter never left me. And then in 2012, my mother was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, which has horrible survival statistics. So we knew that she was unlikely to last more than a year. And I took careful notes and talked with her during those 9 months and began to write even as she was ill. So after her death, I did not turn that into a book right away, but I discovered the Object Lessons series, and that seemed the perfect vessel to talk about the complexity of cancer and the way that I saw cancer, not just as a disease, but a cultural phenomenon that we should be talking about.
Well, you definitely have convinced me of that. And it's a beautiful volume, both Tumor, your book, and then this series, which is quite extensive. I mean, there's more than 24 titles. But for our listeners' benefit, tell us about the series Object Lessons, kind of what the goals are, and, you know, maybe if you remember some of the other topics.
The series is fantastic. They're small books. They all have the same look in terms of the size and shape and color. It's a black background with a striking image on the front. And each book deals with a different object, what it is, how it works in the culture, how we talk about the object. One of my favorites is actually sock, which you think is sort of a mundane topic, but Kim Adrian does a marvelous job talking about what socks really mean in the world. One of the newer books is by Andrew Bomback, and he's a doctor, and he writes about doctor as an object. My favorite in the series is probably Silence, which I think is not an object at all, but I'll give them credit for taking the risk and treating Silence as an object. It's a beautiful book.
And as you stated, I mean, these are just gorgeous, elegant little volumes. They're paperback, but they have sort of a paperback jacket, and they're just beautifully produced, so they're just very readable. And I would hasten to say they're kind of quick reads. I think I read in somewhere in your volume that they're about 25,000 words, so, you know, much shorter than, you know, usual book length. So really kind of a series of essays more than anything, but strung together thematically. And you gave a couple of very good examples. Sock. There's also, I mean, just to, by way of example, there's hotel, there's egg, there's traffic, there's one on jet lag, one on shopping mall. I have not read all of these, but I intend to check out many of them because they're really neat. So what led you?
I'm glad that you brought up the length, too. I think the length is really important in terms of everybody who's commuting or doesn't have enough time to tackle a big book. There's an awful lot packed into each of these books, and I think that's part of the purpose of the series.
So what led you to conceptualize writing about cancer, as it were, or as the object you write about tumor? What led you to pitch it to Bloomsbury, or did they come after you? How did that work out?
I pitched it to Bloomsbury. They have both an article series and a book series. So I tested the waters with an article I wrote about the chemoport, the device that's placed under the skin near the clavicle, and blood can be drawn from the port or chemo can be given through the port. And I wrote a short article about that and pitched that through their article branch of Object Lessons, and it appeared in The Atlantic. And then I pitched the book as a larger project because there was so much more I wanted to say in that vein and to explore the science and culture surrounding cancer.
And one of the things I think that's so interesting is you obviously are a very talented writer, I can just say by having read this book.
Thank you.
But you are, you know, and often on this program we interview scientists or medical professionals, which you are not, but you are a professor of creative writing, which is very appealing to me. And so I saw a video that I think was produced by Chapman University where you work, and you talked about your approach to students. And I think one of the things that you emphasize is for your students having real world experiences, and you mentioned science in it. So what is your approach to science and medicine as far as your creative process?
I have always found science fascinating. As a kid, I loved my science classes. When I went off to college, I thought I wanted to be a surgeon. I got distracted very quickly by creative writing and realized that my love of language was probably greater than my love of science, and yet I couldn't let the science go. So I think of myself as not doing science, but perhaps using science to say the things that I think I need to say or that I want to share with the larger culture. I work with some scientists here at Chapman University who have been fantastic. There were a couple of parts of Tumor that were very difficult for me to write because I didn't really grasp the science at first. I had a long talk with Marco Pisafi, who researches the cells around tumors in prostate and breast cancer, and we had a wonderful conversation about what that meant, and he was very good about explaining the hardcore research he was doing in a way that I could translate for the public. There's also a section in which I talk about some mathematical modeling, and I'm still not sure that I understand exactly what those researchers are doing, but I did capture the gist of it so that regular people like me can understand what's going on the frontiers of scientific research and medical research.
You certainly don't have to be a scientist or a doctor to understand this book, and it is definitely aimed at a regular audience. And one of the things I think that I liked is that you open it with these stories of your parents who each had cancer at different times of different types. And I think what you demonstrate emphatically, in a sense, is that you're willing, perhaps as is your profession, a professor, you're willing to delve in and look for the knowledge to sort of help understand what's going on rather than just be afraid. And it's sort of like confronting your fears, it seems like.
I think that's part of it. The most wonderful comment by a reader that I've had about Tumor, and I've had lots of readers write to me or say that they enjoyed the book, but my aunt, my mother's sister, read the book, and she hasn't been a lifelong reader, but she's taken up reading in the last decade or so, and she didn't expect to like the book, and I think that was because she knew that I would be writing about her sister, my mother, and her response was, the book is not nearly as sad as I thought it would be, and that was really important to me because cancer is sad. When someone is diagnosed with cancer that we love, that's really terribly sad. But cancer is bigger than that, and so I think that you're right that part of the reason I wrote the book, and I hope people will read the book, is because cancer is not only about fear. Fear may be part of it, but I think there are other ways to talk about it, other ways to live with it, and other ways to survive with it.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Anna Leahy. She is a professor of creative writing at Chapman University and author of the book Tumor. She's also the author of the resource Conversing with Cancer, which she co-authored with Lisa Sparks, which is subtitled How to Ask Questions, Find and Share Information, and Make the Best Decisions. And that is a handbook really geared toward patients with cancer, but also healthcare professionals. And we're focusing really this interview on Tumor. And Anna, you talked about your mom's pancreatic cancer, and I thought that you wrote about it in such a way that both you related sort of the grim statistics about pancreatic cancer, but also your mother's journey and how you were there alongside of her and what she had to put up with. Can you summarize sort of how her journey went and kind of the decisions that she made or you made together as a family?
Those are always difficult questions. What were the decisions? How did you make them? She was diagnosed in 2012. I believe it was in April, although she had been sick and she knew something was terribly wrong. My mother was a lawyer, so she dealt with things very matter-of-factly. So when she went to have the imaging that would determine whether there was really something wrong and then the biopsy, she knew what was likely. And so she went on the internet and looked up pancreatic cancer and saw the survival rates and the average survival time. And she decided that she probably had a year left, and she began going over her assets. I think that's very unusual for someone who has just been diagnosed with cancer, but that came out of her background as a lawyer, and that was the way she dealt with it. Other people, I think, would deal with it very differently. And so we explored some medical options. At first, the tumor looked as if it could be resected, could be removed, which then gives the patient much better outcomes. It turned out during the surgery, the tumor was attached in a way that the surgeon could not remove it. So once she was out of surgery, we knew that the statistical probability of her surviving more than a year was almost nothing. And so we dealt with that and made our decisions accordingly. My mother's greatest fear was being in pain. And the doctors were very good about asking her what was most important: quantity of life, quality of life, what kinds of discomfort were worse than others, and our decisions were made accordingly. But you make the best decisions you can, and then things sometimes go the way you think, and sometimes they don't go the way you think. One of the unexpected things that happened with my mother was that on the day she finished her chemotherapy, so she had been through multiple rounds, and that was the last chemotherapy, we came home and her walker, she didn't use a walker before cancer, but as she progressed, she needed a walker. And her walker got caught on the rug and she fell. And it turned out she cracked her hip. So at the very time when she thought she would have some chemo-free weeks and some freedom to move around and see friends, she was then laid up with the hip fracture. So it's very unpredictable, and everybody needs to make decisions based on their own situation. We made the best decisions that we could. My mother took the lead. We didn't make any decisions for her, but she certainly included us in decisions. And that's going to be different for every family, too. Some families are going to want to make very collective decisions, and other families will want to make very individual decisions.
Well, that story of her falling right after completing chemotherapy really resonated, because I see this both as a professional but also in my own family life, where it's sort of the unintended consequences of sort of the poison you choose versus the poison you don't choose. I mean, with cancer especially, if the disease progresses, it can weaken the individual. But sometimes the treatments we give, and you write about this very elegantly, obviously with chemotherapy, for example, the goal is to poison the cancer cells while hopefully sparing the healthy, normal body cells. But that doesn't always happen. And so sometimes patients are weakened and then wind up with other complications. And I guess your mom's hip fracture being an example of that. Can you contrast your mom's story? Your dad had a very different type of cancer. In fact, one that I don't think was ever really, the origin of which was never really able to be determined.
Correct. In some ways, my mother's cancer and father's cancer were very similar. They received some of the same chemotherapy. They had some of the same symptoms, but they had cancer 30-some years apart, and so treatment was different. In addition, my father had liver cancer, which is usually associated with things like alcoholism. But he was only 48, and he was not a heavy drinker, and the doctors couldn't figure out why he had developed this particular kind of cancer. In addition, it had spread throughout his abdomen and did not have a primary tumor in the liver, which is highly unusual. It turned out that during his military service, he was in the Army for a couple of years, he served in Germany at an arms depot, And his job was to clean nuclear warheads that soldiers brought back from the field. And the doctors presumed that his exposure to radiation during that time, which had been decades before, was the reason that he developed liver cancer. We were never able to establish that, in part because the Army's records, most of the Army's records, burned in a fire in St. Louis. But the doctors were pretty sure that that was a reasonable explanation for his cancer. And it was the mid-1980s, and our treatment has certainly changed since then. He received really significant chemotherapy throughout the 5 years that he lived. But initially, he was expected to live between 2 and 6 weeks. I think the reason that he lived 5 years, or almost 5 years, was because the doctors treated it so aggressively because he was young, and because it boggled his mind that a 48-year-old who had been absolutely healthy until that point would be on the verge of death. So I think his attitude was very positive, and the doctors treated him that way.
You write in one of the chapters in the book Tumor about radiation. You talk about radiation both as a carcinogen, as something that can cause cancer, and how we use radiation both in diagnostics, that is things like x-rays or CAT scans, but also in treatment, like radiation therapy. I was very impressed with your descriptions of it because while we know that radiation, for example, like the nuclear accident at Chernobyl, can lead those kinds of spills, can lead to the causation of cancer, we don't really have a good understanding of who in particular might be affected because, of course, every individual is different. And when we talk about radiation causing cancer, it tends to be more of a population-type phenomenon. And so, like, even in your dad's case, while that is an excellent supposition that he was exposed to nuclear radiation cleaning these warheads, I don't think we can ever know for sure. But tell me your thoughts. You actually focus on former President Jimmy Carter, who famously or not survived melanoma at age 90. And one thing you taught me that I had no idea was that so many members of his family died from pancreatic cancer. So in some ways, he was the outlier in living a long life. But that as a nuclear engineer in the Navy, he was involved in a nuclear accident in Canada where he had to literally run in and try to take apart this reactor that had leaked or something. And it was such a shocking story that I had never heard before. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That was most fun for me to write. When I decided to write a book about cancer, I did not expect to talk about Jimmy Carter at all. He was the first president I remember watching the election results for. So I have a fondness for him as part of my own coming of age. And I had no idea he had this history. I did notice that some of his family had died of pancreatic cancer. But when I started researching this book, I really dug into Jimmy Carter's story. And his father and his three siblings all died of pancreatic cancer. His mother died of breast cancer, but it had metastasized to the pancreas. So his family had some kind of problem with the pancreas. His doctors thought that he was at higher risk, and so for a while they did medical imaging to try to detect any pancreatic cancer as early as possible. And at some point, when they hadn't detected any pancreatic cancer, they gave up on the medical imaging because they didn't want to expose him to more radiation. But as you said, we can never know for sure the cause and effect relationship with exposure to radiation. So did his earlier work with a nuclear accident in Canada prevent cancer that he would have otherwise gotten? Did he have significant exposure that made him at higher risk? The melanoma would be common for someone who spent as much time in the sun as Jimmy Carter has over his lifetime. But his story is really amazing, not only for the family background, but for his current treatment and the rise of immunotherapy as a possibility for cancer patients, even though it doesn't work for all cancers or for all patients with a particular kind of cancer. It's really a marvelous innovation in recent years.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Chewin. My guest today is Anna Leahy. She is a professor of creative writing at Chapman University and author of the book Tumor, which is part of the Object Lessons series on a number of different objects, the series is, from Bloomsbury. She's also the author of a volume called Conversing with Cancer, co-authored with Lisa Sparks, How to Ask Questions, Find and Share Information, and Make the Best Decisions. And both of these, taken together as creative works, really do demonstrate what you alluded to earlier, your love of language. And Anna, I just wanted to ask you a couple of things here. In the small volume, Tumor, you really help the reader, I think, understand the language around cancer, some of the etymologies of words, or certainly some of the usages. So, for example, you wrestle with one of the terms that comes up a lot in general healthcare, which is screening. And so in medicine, we think of screening as sort of screening the general population for diseases, and often in cancer, when we think of, say, we do mammograms to try to find tumors if they're there, or cancer early so that it can be treated, similarly for prostate cancer or even lung cancer. But screening clearly has other definitions. So tell us how you framed that discussion.
I'm glad you noticed the way I talk about language. I talk a lot about the metaphors we use to talk about cancer and particular words like screen or screening. I am fascinated by words that mean two things at once or that mean more than one thing, even if you're trying to use them as meaning just one thing. So the word screen, as you pointed out, is about detection, about finding something, about looking at something carefully and systematically. But we also put screens on our windows. Screen is also something that obscures the view. So I wanted to get at the way language is slippery and that there's no one way to talk about cancer. There's not one way to talk about one's own experience of cancer. There are multiple ways of looking at it, and we do that through language and the words we choose and the metaphors we choose to talk about it.
There's another term, well, there are many others, but another one I wanted to ask you about was margin. And toward the end of the book, you talk about the concept of clear margins, which is sort of a treatment goal of physicians, really in, I guess, surgical oncology. So when a tumor, which is the subject of your book, is removed, the surgeon, the physician is hopeful to get clean margins. But as you point out, they're not always as clean as we might hope. Tell us what you learned.
I learned about the field of field cancerization when I was looking at what does a clean margin mean, and is there any such thing as a truly clean margin where there are no cancer cells beyond what's been cut out, beyond the surrounding tissue of the tumor. And my colleague here at Chapman University, Marco Bassoffi, has been looking at this issue in prostate cancer and breast cancer. And what scientists have been finding is that there are molecular changes beyond the edge of the margin. So there are no cancer cells in a clean margin, but there may be molecular changes beyond that. The thinking is that these changes could lead to cancer, that molecular changes in the tissue can give rise to cancer sometime in the future. So they would increase a person's risk. However, there exists the possibility that the tumor itself has changed the tissue around it. And so the molecular changes might be an effect of the tumor rather than the cause of a tumor. And I find that very interesting that these two possibilities exist and that we're doing research to try to pinpoint the answer, but we just don't know everything we need to know at this point.
Yeah, and I thought your discussion of it was really spot on. I mean, it really left me kind of both interested as a reader and then puzzled as to how do we answer these scientific questions? Because we just have this human tendency, I think, to try to simplify things as black or white, or cured, not cured, margin clean, not clean. But as with all things in life, it seems like sometimes there's kind of a fuzzy border. Well, let's go back to basics. And, you know, the name of the book is Tumor. Remind us what tumor actually means or how you explored the language. And then there are these words often associated with tumor that describe them. There's benign tumor and malignant tumor. And I guess if you can just remind us what those things mean or how you wrestled with them. And I know that really is like kind of your whole book, but here in the final few moments, if you can clarify those for us.
A tumor is basically an overgrowth of cells. What I found fascinating was that the overgrowth of cells is really cells doing what they're supposed to do. In the case of a tumor, those cells are just doing their reproduction too well, and they can't stop, and it gets carried away. So a tumor is a bad thing because it's a good thing gone awry. A benign tumor is this proliferation of cells without the possibility that it's going to spread. It stays where it is. A malignant cancer, a malignant tumor, has the ability to spread throughout the body. And so that's why cancer is so dangerous, this idea of spreading from where it started to other parts of the body. There are other interesting tumors. I talk a little bit about teratomas, which are misplaced cells that then grow into as much of a body as they can. So a tumor might hold hair and teeth and body parts in the wrong place. So I ended up exploring more than cancer because of this larger idea of tumor and the way that the body's cells reproduce and reproduce and reproduce. And we want them to reproduce. We just don't want them to reproduce too fast all at once.
Or in the wrong place.
Or in the wrong place.
Yeah. You also had yourself, I mean, in that opening chapter where you talk about your parents, you had a cancer scare, but not cancer itself, I guess. Is that something you're willing to share?
Absolutely. I think it's important that we do talk about cancer. I remember as a kid when John Wayne first started talking about his own cancer, and I remember all the adults thinking that that was an amazing thing that he had said the word cancer out loud in public. So I think it's very important to talk about our own experiences. With my experience, I went in for my annual mammogram, and on the imaging, they saw 3 calcifications, which is probably no big deal, but they wanted to watch it. And I came back 6 months later for another mammogram, and there were lots more calcifications. And that is not cancer, but can be an indication that cancer might be growing. And so they did a biopsy. They found some abnormal cells. Again, not cancer, but definitely increases the risk that cancer would develop there. So I did have surgery to remove the abnormal cells, and I have been healthy and happy ever since. I get my regular screening. Not all women my age need annual screening, but those of us with high risk tend to think that that's a very good idea, that the risks outweigh the risks of the imaging itself. So I've been keeping up with my mammograms, and I'm doing quite well now.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that. The name of the volume is Tumor, and it's part of the Object Lessons series from Bloomsbury. And if you, like me, are someone who likes a more literary take on things or a much better and not dry scientific explanation of phenomena that occur in our body or with oncology or with cancer, then you should pick up this volume called simply Tumor by my guest today, Anna Leahy, who is a professor of creative writing at Chapman University. Anna Leahy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. This has been a great conversation.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.